black vials of blood samples, and they were normal, of course. And so it was also a bigger shock to see him sit around the hangar waiting on the train. So I finally prevailed on Professor Morrison that on the shock ward cases, I got back to Fort Wainwright and landed out on the military base for intensive care, the altitude sickness cases from the troops of the Institute of Archaeology, that I should also, and could haul away, if possible, load up a whole box full of these vials and take them direct to Wainwright, and they might get some good results. So this took place one time, and after that, I flew all the blood samples directly to Fairbanks, because blood's the most perishable thing in the world, and even refrigerated, it loses its chemical secrets. So anyway, that's a point in favor.
They didn't know before this.
Well, anybody would know that you can't take it and let it sit in an old red-hot hangar.
No, I meant the color change. They were aware
they knew
of it
that.
Until they did that, or they knew
well, that. I'm sure they must have known, because they're experts on it. Maybe, well, not so much experts. If they had all the answers, and they would have been there. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. As long as you mentioned the airdrop and also...
The guys that went up, were they climbers or?
Oh yeah, Gary Cole still remains at 17,100 foot, buried in ice. He was a fine athlete and about 20 some years.
He was up in the morning
alive. Yeah, he was one of the institutes.
Saw his picture.
Yeah, well,
Russia Pep.
Yeah, fine guy. And he was a great specimen, a good athlete, but he just had an affinity for altitude, and he caught pulmonary edema, pneumonia at altitude, and he died like a dog. I told him to get him down to 14.3 if they lose him, and they did. He said he's too sick to move, the same as Jattinger. By the way, where's the Jattinger chapter?
I didn't write it. Now, for the simple reason, Doc.
Too much of a parallel.
Yeah, it's too parallel to what we've got, and it was almost a choice between Wilcox and Jack.
Yeah, this chapter 10, page 12, middle of the page, No. I wonder how we could improve on this.
What is it?
With this realization, Sheldon's hands and eyes begin to fly the airplane. But boy, what do you think was flying it prior to getting into the trap? Because it looked like a sure thing. See? Wonder how we can make it more presentable. See, conscious logic and careful planning. Well, that went out the window, but as soon as you pointed the thing in that black crevice, there's tremendous steep, high, jagged rock walls on both sides, and it's a blind black canyon. You know you can't turn. Conscious logic and careful planning. Well, that went out the window.
In other words, you were flying
a couple of
by
the numbers. Well, but manipulation. No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that you use up the next 6 years of good luck on the first attempt at landing there, maybe. I wouldn't, that don't go conscious logic. If you didn't have a little bit of luck, plus some conscious logic and careful planning, you'd have never made it, period. This is an untrue set of statements here. Now, all the while we're missing the peaks in the rain and the snow and the over thickening overcast, the dark overcast, you're using everything you've got, plus some things you wish you had, and you're wondering if you should have stayed home in bed or call the whole thing off and when half of the freight was hauled. Boy, I think we ought to knock that out. As a understatement here, and it's not a true statement. It ought to be rephrased here, or left completely out.
Well, you got to say something.
Woo! This is the wrong thing. This is a direct contradiction.
You tell me what it should be.
Well,
you were there. I wasn't.
Well, listen, you got.
I mean, that's what
you use everything you had and wish for more in a situation like this. And these are not true statements, because not at this point did you begin to fly the airplane. If you haven't been flying the airplane, you'd have never got halfway there to start with. I know, but this is.
Well, it's not saying that you weren't flying the airplane before that.
Yeah, but
it was saying that you were flying in there, biological method, you were navigating where you were going.
Well, here's a statement that's absolutely not true. Conscious logic and careful planning caused by with the number, coupled with by the numbers manipulation of the cup stick were useless. No, you use the numbers. You do not want to get below the stall speed. You do not want to make a useless turn in a black chasm. You use everything you possess to keep that airplane from spinning and crashing and burning. This is not a true statement.
Okay.
Conscious logic and planning.
All right, I'll buy that. But now, let's listen now for a minute. You described the difference then between when you were calmly and coolly flying along, no problems yet.
Going I knew there would be problems. It wasn't calm.
Right, cool. But you didn't know you were going to have landing flares blow out in front of you.
Well, that's true.
You didn't
true.
Know that you were going to be able to not make a turn, period.
Well, I knew that you couldn't make a turn.
One way ride in there. Okay, but you didn't know you were going to do it on a black landing strip.
Well, there was...
you wouldn't have gone in there.
Once
sure
committed,
you
straight ahead, there was no possible
exactly.
chance of turning
All right,
around.
Now, up to the point where you got committed and there was no possible choice, and you saw your flares blowing out
just
in front of your eyes.
For 10 miles. You didn't dare make a turn.
What's the difference between from that point on and before?
Well, but here, this is an untrue statement. Conscious logic, careful planning coupled with by the numbers manipulation of the cup stick were useless. It's never useless to manipulate by the numbers.
So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that once you entered this chasm, you were committed, period. And the numbers of the plane, what it stalls at in the turn, the capabilities of being not being able to see, we're in this monster of a
trap. You were sitting there. You were sitting there. You said, now I've got to land on this runway. And
it's not a runway. It's just a
Strip on a glacier.
Yeah, and
it's pitch black, and the flares are being blown out, and I can't turn. Let's see now. This thing stalls at 65 miles an hour.
No. You don't have time to analyze.
Exactly.
Yeah, but
you're flying her by the seat of your pants. You aren't paying attention to what the book says that airplane will do. You're driving it, and you're watching those things. You're not paying any attention to what the airplane's doing. You can't.
You certainly are.
You're not sitting there watching your turn and bank.
Out. You're scanning the turn and bank.
All right.
You're
not sitting there watching airspeed.
You certainly are.
Oh, come on.
Listen, if in pitch, you ever get under the hood and see if you don't watch the airspeed. If you don't
watch the airspeed.
And you peek out occasionally.
Yeah. Okay.
You spend 8/10 of your time scanning. And the other 2/10 of your time stealing the glance to see if you could see any clue that'll.
So you weren't flying an airplane by the seat of your pants. Then.
You were
making an instrument landing without without the aid of a beam.
That's wrong. You don't have a glide slope to watch.
Watching instruments?
You are watching instruments. You're sneaking a peek outside the cockpit to try to orient yourself in case of a sneaky turn creeps in. It's
we're hung up on
statement.
Details.
No,
scratch
no.
it out and we'll go on.
Yeah.
Hell with it. Scratch it out
maybe.
And we'll just omit it from the book.
No.
Hell, I don't want to. Look it. Let's not waste tape hung up on a little trivia.
No.
Because that's what this is.
Listen, a lot of guys are doing a lot of flying.
Yeah, you know, I know.
30, sure. 4 years of experience, you're going to be reading this.
Scratch it out.
No, once committed, let's say...
Either that or tell me how to write it.
Right.
Two.
Well,
because
I would
the tape's
say,
going by and we're burning her up.
Right. I would say, once committed, it required all conscious effort and logic and everything ever learned about the numbers
okay.
to keep from spinning that airplane into
good.
The ice.
Let's go on to the next issue.
Okay.
We got her done. See you.
In the Dan Cuddy sheet mine, when I located this sheer ridge of slate, that was now, I noticed there was sheep trails across this sheer ridge, and I mean it was sheer. It was 70-80% steep. And yet, somehow, the beautiful doll sheep, which you say I call the damn sheep, I have too much respect for the beautiful sheep to call them damn sheep, honest. Even though I fell 400 feet and almost killed myself, it's still not the damn sheep, because that's not my manner.
Oh, okay,
yeah, you know.
You're not.
No, I'm not pure or anything like that, but I just want to
true.
Mention.
But you can't make me believe that when you
then
slid
I didn't
down
call
that
damn
slope
after I fell
all right,
400 feet.
You fell 400 feet, and the guy says, geez, Don, what happened when you got down here? Oh, man, I thought I could follow that damn sheep across that slate, and I couldn't do it.
No.
You never say that.
I was so beat. I might have. I didn't say it, but I probably should have.
I don't think you know it, really.
Yeah, but
what
the thing
said,
is,
see, that's
here's
now
the
we're
thing.
Back to what Kime said, see.
No.
You can't remember exactly what you said.
Well, but I know.
I love sheep, too. I think they're the greatest animal in the world.
Yeah, but.
I love that Labrador I got out there, and she's worth probably $1,500 right now. But I've cussed her out a couple of times under my breath. Don't kid yourself.
Yeah, but...
And I didn't mean a word of it, like most of us don't,
when
you use mild profanity.
Yeah, but anyway, there's a...
We leave it out if you want.
That's debatable.
Make any difference. That's for you to say, you know.
Yeah, but anyway... while we're on the subject of the fall...
Well, I remember, that's a minor incident.
I know, but let me just point out something for your own information. See, it wasn't simple. A few things in this world are really simple. Most of them are complicated. The fall was complicated. Not the fall, but the recovery was complicated. But I was in the deep.
Fall was easy.
Yeah, fall took no problem. Listen, I ball milled down the side of that mountain. And it's 70 or 80 degrees steep, and every time you hit and bounce, you cut yourself on the sharp rocks and the shale. And you're covered from head to foot with abrasions. I set my right shoulder down by my fifth rib, and I was blood from head to foot, and I didn't know to tell you the truth where I did hurt the worst. And I'm under some rock, and I'm barely able to howl. And finally, it took them about 2 hours to get to where I was at, coming to different route, of course. They didn't want to fall the same route. Okay. Now, they said, we're going to cover him up with our coats and go for the plane. I said, hey, fellas, I don't know what part of me's hurt the worst. I can't hardly breathe, but that's the wrong thing to do. So I'm going to go with you back to the plane. They said, well, can you walk? And I said, well, let me get some of these rocks off my legs and let's see. So I could stagger. So it took 2 days. I didn't leap up out from under the rock pile with dislocated shoulders and cracked ribs and cut from head to foot and my pants and everything else tore up. I just, you see, a rock cut is the worst kind because the rock dust is like salt. And you hurt and burn like you wouldn't believe. Well, anyway, we made it halfway to the plane before dark, and we camped the face of a glacier. And then when I got good and stiff in the morning, we got started off and roped up over the face of this glacier the rest of the 60 miles to plane. So it wasn't so simple as to...
That'll be an excellent part in our next book.
Leap up and go barreling off to the plane.
Hey,
because you can't even breathe with your damn shoulder set. That would be your best rib.
But the answer to the customer's problem. We call it the damn sheep trail instead of the damn sheep.
Oh.
And then you're crossing the sheep trail.
Yeah, that impressive.
You're not being derogatory toward the sheep.
So. Yeah, okay. No.
Pretty willy though.
Yeah, okay. And so he say, how I come to Talkeetna? I say, the bus, the train, and rental cars all come to Talkeetna. Oh, rental car? Hurts you drive? Yeah, yeah. Ava's too. So we come to Talkeetna at 1 o'clock. Okay, I'm waiting at 1 o'clock. This cameraman, he's got 18 cameras hanging from his neck. He looked like a bull moose there. Went through a picket fence or something. But anyway, I say, I am Mr. Natawabi, and I come with camels. I hear 1 o'clock, right? I say, right. I say, where is the mountain? You know mountain? Yeah, I know mountain. I say, give him a plane or go. I say, you must be traded to Japan. What you mean? Me traded to Japan? I say, yes, you are traded to Japan. I see you have a Hasselblad Swedish camera hanging from neck with other 17 cameras.
Yeah.
He say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about Hasselblad.
Yeah.
He says, only climb along, not police up at 19,000 feet. So then my troubles begin. This was before the advent of the turbo supercharged Cessna. He say, I must take all three assistants with me. I say, climb on.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what the out of print is or not, but anyway, so I can get to 17,000 feet with three passengers, assistants, plus the great cameraman from Japan with Nikon camera. I get to 17,000 feet and it won't go one inch higher. I tried the thermals on the east ridge. I tried the turbulence on the west side. I tried everything. The standing wave cloud from the north, nothing worked. 17,000, that's all I could get. And all the time, Japanese Klamelman with Nikon Klamela says, I must have 19,000 feet for next picture series. I say, my, look at standing wave lenticular buildup on the north side of McKinley. Yeah, yeah, this is very interesting. Now I said, you see that third multiple hat on top of the big animal bottom? Yes, yes, what does that mean? I say, this indicates winds. Maybe we find thermal. And while he's looking, I say, look to the southeast ridge, and maybe big thermal air. What shall I look for? I say, look for blowing snow up ridge. That's up thermal. And he say, yes, and from east side? Yeah, I say, southeast side. And while he's busily looking for up draft thermals from southeast approach, I reach over and crank in 19,000 feet, which is 10 more millibars of mercury, and I say, tremendous, we've just now reached a tremendous thermal, we are now 19,000 feet, and he say, terrific, terrific, he says, let me grip my Hasselblad. We open the windows, I say, yes, use Hasselblad so it does not rain. We are now
dude, we gotta put that in there, down. That's
19,000 feet, according to the altimeter, according to the absolute altitude, we are now at 17,000 feet, period, and that's as high as a plane will go, thermals or no thermals. And he took all kinds of pictures and run out of film and went home happy.
Yeah.
I don't think we ought to print that.
Wouldn't name them.
No. What I really did was change 20 millibars of mercury, 10 per thousand feet. And you suddenly arrive at 19,000 feet, just like that.
Sure.
But what could I do? He insists on being at 19,000.
I think we ought to put that in there. I think that's funny.
Now, apparently this is chapter 11, page 26. Now, here's a big, a really important snarla. Now, when we first arrived, bottom of the page, at the Rotman Hotel, room 5.
By the way, is that spelled right down below?
R-O-T-M-A-N.
I spelled it R-O-T-H.
Well, you better check on that. It's easy to check on. Be in the phone book.
Is it still there?
Somewhere here. But anyway, at the bottom of the page.
Is the hotel still there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's fine.
And it's still called that?
Yeah. Okay. Here's the thing. Looky, when we first arrived, now this is for sure, it was a poker game in progress. A poker game, not a dice game. Now, Perry's best hit, his best lick, was in a poker game. He just fancied himself a dice man. That's my opinion, because, man, he got beat like he was blind.
So they were playing poker when he first got there?
Yeah, I got in the poker game. I made a couple $100 pretty easy in the poker game, and I was appalled. I was doing fine. I was banking for Perry and making up not bad. And then Perry hit a hot streak.
You're still playing poker.
Poker. Five-card draw poker. You know, couldn't beat him with a club. And it was a good square game. And then, after two or three polar bear hunters and Leon Schellenberger, who were in the game, went broke or dropped out or got permanently discouraged, then O'Connell disappeared. He likewise got bit. We just about cleaned him out there, mostly Perry, but I hit him pretty good late. And then O'Connell reappeared. Two things was important. He brought a set of dice, 4, 5, 6 dice. Schellenberger, who went completely broke on three of a kind, on three small cards, he bet into a flush with three small cards. And I thought he may have had, he was looking for the fourth. See, this leads you to, in draw poker, to trouble. If you get wild. If you start in with three small cards, you have the opportunity to make a full house, two of another kind, or the fourth card of whatever you have. Now, if they're small pairs, you still don't want to get in there with both feet, because the odds are, if you read your poker book, pretty great against picking up the fourth small card. If you make it, then you're still in trouble, because there's so many combinations that you can be beat with. Now, four of a kind, say you have four deuces. Huh. Four deuces can be beat by a lot of things. There's a dozen combinations that'll beat it. Okay, so much for that.
Okay, so they now began playing dice. And
yeah, and they bet like mad on uneducated poker, see? And Perry knows the odds. And furthermore, he's a tremendous thief if he's playing on somebody's money. And you'll steal them blind and beat them to death with their own money, that's his game. And he's good at it. But that's the way all big poker players play. Now you play to get all my money or her money, and then you bluff us out of the big pots. You bet $500, and you have in draw poker, say, a pair showing or an ace showing. You lead them to believe you got aces back to back. If you get another face card on the third card that helps your ace up, why, you could run everybody in the world out. Because you might be sitting on three aces. Now, the way to really play it is to, if you have aces back to back, is to play along with the field and then sand trap. I don't want to get into the cards. But I do want to say that it's a game of psychology and it's a game of skill. And if you play enough of it, well, you get pretty good at it. But basically, leave her on. Don't stop it. Because when everybody went broke due to superior dealing and handling and analyzing someone else's hand and watching the people play and imagining what they had for cards with the straight deck, Perry was way ahead of the game and I was ahead of it some. Then O'Connell brings in this dice, the three dice, you know, the 4, 5, 6 game is in a box, and you splash it into a sidewall or you bank it into the head of a bedstead or whatever. Anyway, the complexion changed thereafter, and I got out because of the 4, 5, 6 game because it got too wild. And
you mean from the standpoint of money involved?
Yeah, and it was clear what was going on, but Perry didn't believe it. And O'Connell was a dice artist. He was a mechanic, they call him. Now, what's a mechanic? A mechanic's a guy that can throw the dice he wants. I explained that to you once. Of the rolling dice flap, and the one dice beats the box apart, the guy shakes the box like this, slams the dice into the backboard. You think all the dice hit the board. Only one dice slammed to the board, the other two spun flat with the numbers the guy wanted on. It's like running a magic show. Only there's a lot of money in it if you can do it right without getting caught. Okay, this is maybe not truly what was happening, but approximately what happened. And that's how I wanted to. You've got the 4, 5, 6 game before the poker game. The 4, 5, 6 game ended the argument because that's the one.
That's
the one. Perry went for one. That's chapter 11, page 829. Now, here's a questionable statement on the tail end of this 4, 5, 6 game disaster. And that is that Sheldon never learned the post-trip fate of Perry, the fur buyer, but he shrinks innerly when he considers the reaction of his father, the furrier. Well, he was a force to be reckoned with, all right. When he discovered the large shortage in the receipts that remained in the old black leather medical case. If the post-trip fate of Perry would have been disastrous, I'd have known about it, because Perry, I see him quite often. If the old man would have killed him on the spot, which he should have done, well, I'd have known about it.
But you didn't know how he read him out either. You know,
I can imagine that he just chewed
him out
tomorrow.
And that's what I was getting at. You know, you never did really find out what happened. But just all you could
Man.
Just a way of ending the story, you know.
Yeah.
So, by the way, Rotman is Rotman.
Yeah.
Rotman.
Yeah.
Rotman. So, well, it's at the Sheldon there. And we want to make...
Well, speaking of the minus 148, listen, one of the things that I hoped to put on the tape, but might have missed it, that it'd be an awful good punchline, You recall that January 67 was a winter climb, right? All right, the disaster of the Wilcox expedition was in August, or July or August, before we got it up 67, right? No, it was in at least July, at the time they perished, all right? Now, here, Davidson, Janae, Johnson, and Blomberg survived at this unconscious wind chill factors, 148 below, and who knows, maybe even colder, in the middle of January, and the Wilcox expedition goes waltzing around up there and perish in the same place in the middle of July. What about that?
Shame of it is, though, that we're not writing up the winter climb.
No, but I'd sure put that.
Oh, yeah,
I wanted to. I put the comparison in there.
You could put the comparison in there, but it would be nice, you know, if we were writing the winter climb up, and we could use the others. See, then we could say, man, look at what Wilcox did. He went up there, lost several guys, you know, and maybe 80 below zero chill factor, you know, or 70 below zero.
Might have only been 30 below too.
And
that's
then,
I don't want to get 20 below.
Plus, it was light too, and not dark all the time.
Yeah. Well. Here, let's not keep you awake all night.
That must have been a rotten trip for staying up there 4 or 5 years.
And not much of a cave that
couldn't sit up there.
Wow. It's just a trench.
Five years.
They just beat that ice until they pulverized it down deep enough to barely lay in. And then it hadn't been for quite boots at all, but right.
When you met, before you got married,
yeah.
Roberta asked you if you needed a secretary.
I said, listen, if I got the right kind of a secretary, she'd be worth $18,000 a year and board. And I said, what do you think of that? And somebody said, opportunities. Rapping lightly with brass knuckles.
Yeah.
And so the long and the short of it is, now coming up 10 years later, I remember this was $18,000 a year in board. So far, she's got the board.
Okay. <That's>
anyway, she said, as they say, these women are in the gambling circles, they say it even better. They say the smart ones take it away from the dumb ones. Now we're talking about gambling for money in dice games and card games. And then that leaves the smart ones in possession, right, of all this easy money that they took from the dumb ones. And then the women get it away from the smart ones.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So in the further course of other meetings, it was decided that I needed more than a secretary. Now, when we became established in Talkeetna, dear wife Roberta said, "Say." I notice that this 40,000 gallon bulk plant and the 4,000 gallon reserve in the gasoline shed is rapidly dwindling. The people we have hired must be poor mathematicians that are taking care of our cash. I say, why is that? Well, she says there's barely enough left to buy the next shipment of bulk supplies. So she said, by the way, would it be a good idea if we got rid of something? I say, like the bulk plant? She said, you bet. And what about the boats? And what about the ice cream stand? And what about the airplanes? And what about all these pilots falling over each other? And I says, we need them bad. She said,
yeah.
What part of it do you need? I say, well, okay, you win. We get rid of everything but the 6 airplanes. And so we did. See?
Yeah.
And we cleared the atmosphere somewhat. And I retained one of my favorite airboats, but it was so much faster with the Cessna to haul the same amount of traffic in minutes, whereas it took you hours to cover the same mileage in an airboat, even a fast airboat. But I did want to put in a punchline about Roberta and my original deal of 18,000 a year plus board, and finally up to this date so far she's realized the floor now.
10 years.
So, occasionally, out of blue sky, well, one day, Roberta said, "Say, you remember a discussion in regard to 18,000 a year and board?" And I said, "Yeah, I sort of remember something about that." Well, she says, "When's the payoff?"
Yeah.
And I say, "Well, I've delayed the payoff slightly because you're worth in far excess of 18,000 a year and board." And the reason why, she raises smart, beautiful children, bakes cookies, runs radio stations, answers telephone calls, she cajoles some traffic and sues other irate traffic. For instance, one irate fisherman tumbled out of the Fairview and said that his party had been rooted to the barstools of the Fairview Inn for 2 days, and they wanted to go fishing, and I was goofing around hauling mountaineers. And he allowed that every time he came over to inquire when my arrival date from the mountains would be, Roberta would give him some kind of a sweet stall off, and he'd forget what he came over to talk about and head back for the bar. And his final conclusion was that I didn't really want to take anybody fishing. I was in cahoots with the bartender and was getting a rake off from the drinks. Anyway, oh, brother, I got a billion things. Let me see the most important. Oh, I started to tell you the assets to Talkeetna Air Force via the lady touch of Roberta. Well, continuing, she raises beautiful flowers, a tremendous flower selection, and does all the beautiful things that a wife ought to ever do, and the multitudes of things that secretaries ought to do, like make up income tax. So I thought I'd better get that in there when I was thinking about it. I don't want to stray too far here. I was going to talk about, like, flying the coast out of Point Barrow. Now, I tell you, or Umiak, let's talk about the places where there's no VOR and where the non-directional beacon, the automatic direction finders, we're talking about an automatic direction finder primarily because there aren't any other means of radio waves. Okay. See, here's the problem. At Barrow and at Umiak too. Now, Jungle Jim was often used to have a kind of a franchise on Umiak. Later that changed. Ween run it for a while. And that...
how do you spell his last name?
McGoffin. Jungle Jim McGoffin. Don't you know him? You don't? Oh, my God. Well, he gave Ween such a hard time for years, he almost broke him.
Right?
Yeah, but here's what I want to say. Now, the Umiak non-directional beacon, even with a good ADF, was only good for 15 miles. In other words, you had to know where you was at before you got there, or you'd never find it. And now, wait a minute, let me tell you something else. Ween only turned their non-directional beacon on up in Barrow at their request of their own airplanes. It was a good beacon with a long range. The best beacon in Alaska is Bettles. Man, I could pick up Bettles 200 miles away. That's the way it ought to be. But that isn't the way it always is. Now, from the Wainwright, if you're heading for a barrel, you're faced with something else. Have you told Ween to turn their beacon on? Have you told Jungle Jim to turn his beacon on? Huh! Chances are you can't even contact them, therefore no beacon. Now, can you get Katsi View? No, probably not. Now, if you run into a whiteout condition such as we did, what are you going to chase? The compass? What are you going to chase? Is your gyro set up against the compass? What you need is a radio beam to follow. You need time and distance. In all instrument flying, you have to know where you're at, roughly, and then verify it with what your instruments say, or you're going to get lost, but good. And here's what you have to do. In the case of areas where there's a non-directional beacon. First, it's got to be working. Second, you've got to be able to pick it up. And with the exception of Bell's, which is a fantastic radio beacon, there are a few to match it in all of Alaska that I've tuned in on. So, now, say we're someplace, say, at Galena. And we're going to go nonstop to Bell's. Oh, this is fairly simple, sure. Well, you want to get the mean clearance altitude high enough to miss all the mountains, and then plus another couple thousand feet. Yeah, but then you have to be prepared for a couple of things. You want to know what the Bell's weather is. But primarily, to take off and fly instruments and not have a place to go to on a radio beacon, you're in trouble, because sooner or later you're going to hit something. Therefore, you have to have an operational station to home in on.
And tell what you've got.
You have to know how long you flew and what speed in, and correct for your wind and so forth. So it'd be erroneous to say, I can go up the North Coast, or anybody can go up the North Coast and fly instruments. You can't do it. You've got to have some place to go and some place to come back to. Unless you have a radio range in front of you or behind you, you can take a back course like you would shoot in an ILS landing, except you can read the tail of the automatic direction finder in case of a powerful station behind you, if you know your wind. But this runs into real navigation. So, hold down. I scratched out in several places. He went on instruments. It's true. You can do a 180-degree turn.
What I meant by instrument.
No. You made an instrument 180-degree turn. That's all it was left to do. You did it or crashed.
Okay. Here's what I meant by saying you were on instrument.
No.
Yeah. Let's just listen to what I'm saying now. When I say that you were on instrument, I didn't mean, in fact, I said in there, turn and bank, and put an asterisk on it. There's going to be a footnote that explains. This does not mean the general concept of the word instruments is full navigation.
Just say a full,
so forth.
Don't confuse them with detail. Just tell them you made an instrument 180-degree turn.
All right.
Don't say that you flew, because
you're
listen,
flying
all
the
airline types in Alaska say, I'll bet you my ATR rating, he didn't fly instruments to barrel.
No, realize that. But look at, you're flying on instruments to the extent that you're flying the turn and bank in a whiteout.
No, just rephrase it. He made an instrument turn and bank turn. He made a 180-degree instrument.
In a whiteout, how do you keep the airplane low?
Well, you hold the turn and bank in the middle and...
Sure.
But wait, you're bringing into it something of navigation. Making a turn and navigating is not all one and the same.
Yeah.
If you're going to go to Point Barrow and you're 140 miles away from it, you have to have a radio beam to ride to get there, mister.
Okay, but what you're doing, Don, you're interpreting what I'm saying there.
Yeah, but I interpret that...
Navigating by instruments, and I never said that.
Mm-hmm.
Never said that.
Rephrase it.
Well, I don't have to, because I never said it.
Oh. Well,
you show me in there where I say you're navigating by instruments. You were not going to do it, because it ain't in there.
Well, but I...
what I'm saying
I
is, you're flying the airplane by the gauges because you can't see outside. You don't know which is up and down. You're flying by your turn and bank.
I made the 10
That's flying instruments.
See, what my plan was, it was so thick. I was going to set a course and fly true for 10 minutes. And then do 180 degree turn and make my wind corrections and fly back. True. I'm capable of doing it. The plane had to turn and bank and it's reliable. The compass is not too reliable. However, there's a wind error in there that was the worst part of it. That's how I got screwed up. Okay, when I went back to find Wainwright, I swear I didn't miss it much, but you didn't have to miss it much not to see it at all. So then I turned around and went back to the lagoons. Holy mother. And scanned it up on a map. I just snap judged it to be X miles. But I should scale it off. I've got a lot of barrel charts and stuff.
Yeah, I got a barrel section.
Yeah, it's just take a second to scale.
I'll scale it off.
And don't be sure you get the right figure. Don't read the knot scale. Because, listen, there's guys that do a lot of flying up here. They're going to cast a critical eye on it. And if they find one faulty statement, it's all junk.
Yeah, but look at I know that. And I never said that you're navigating fast.
Yeah, well.
No way. I didn't infer it either.
Not that you couldn't.
All I
but
said
they
was,
had no beam up barrel.
I know that. The thing is, all my reference in there to instruments was literally, in other words, this is an instrument. Turn and bank. You're flying it. You weren't flying by looking at that instrument. You could be this way, or this way in a whiteout. Right?
Yeah.
That's all I meant. I never did say that you navigated by it. You were trying to navigate by it. You were just holding the airplane level and telling whether it was climbing or descending by instruments. That's all. And that's true. I think it is. Well, that's a true statement, isn't it?
You bet. And then I finally did get a glimpse of the pressure ridge, and I was so glad to see it, I hung on to it like it was going out of style. Good. The Fox deal. About end of the argument there. That's way back.
I wish I could get a hold of Davidson. I'd like to get a copy of that picture you just put in front of that paperback. Janae, come up.
Oh. Don't Janae have it?
No. Davidson.
Well,
Davidson.
I see old Davidson every once in a while.
Yeah, you tell him. Tell him good. Man, if you see him, tell him we want some pictures.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get a hold of him short of driving to Anchorage and getting the police to find him. I don't know.
No, he's down in LAS.
Well, I know, but he comes to Anchorage occasionally. He works part-time at the Environmental Protection Agency down there. Some environmental agency. He's a big honcho on the Friends of the Earth, you know, the ecologist movement down there. But that's all I can find out about him. He lives down towards Girdwood between Anchorage and Girdwood. That's it. He doesn't have a telephone.
I don't know when Paris Moore, on page 7 of chapter, nine, top of page, it says Paris Moore was a good hand, and that's for sure. He was making glacier landings quite a while before I even thought of it. I don't know when he started.
Quite a while, I don't know. That's what you said on the other day. And that's an innocuous statement.
I said that?
Yeah.
I did?
You bet.
Well, he made him, it wasn't quite a while, it was the year before. It was in 50 that he took Washburn, and you must have copied the 7,400 foot level from Washburn's tape, and then pick up a 10,000 from tape. Okay, that's fine. That was the year before. Yeah, and page 8 here, in the middle of the page. Now, Washburn and I were in correspondence after his initial visit. See, as I recall, the survey started early in 51. Now, the first flight, I might be a year wrong, but at any rate, the first flight through the Tana was up at the base of the Ruth Glacier. I thought that was 50, but he should say what it was. Okay, that was
right
the fall
of
51.
Yeah.
Okay.
Read right out of the diary.
All right.
That's why.
All right, good. He knows. All right. And then the main event took place starting from the early next spring. Okay. Now, let's put punchline on this $100 a landing. Now, as I recall, we discussed at the time of the sandbar landings the magnitude of the survey, and it was going to last for years, if I can hack it. But I think that it was in a letter that he announced, a letter later following, that, as I recall, we didn't really, the main thing was discuss whether I wanted to tackle the job. We didn't get around to the resource finance part of it until a letter arrived saying that he was pleased that I was interested in the project and that they would offer $100 a landing. Now, as I recall, that came in a letter, and I shot a letter back to him and I said, let's go.
Yeah, when did we start? I'm guessing the plane
we had
right now.
Eight airplanes sitting there
yeah.
with down payments
yeah.
on. And
well, what do I say? That you were doing this in conversation?
Yeah.
Okay,
I now.
This is, it makes a difference because,
oh, yeah, right.
as I recall, I fired him a special delivery airplane
okay.
letter back to Boston. And
that chapter, Don, about 95% of it was written from his tapes. And, he was partially telling me the story, and part of it, most of it actually, reading out of his diary.
Yeah, well.
Now, he wasn't reading out of his diary when he told me that, and he was just discussing it, you know.
Yeah, well.
And he said, I told Don. Now, he might have meant that he told you in
the letter,
see.
Put it in the letter, because I remember
right.
firing him out
no
a special delivery
okay.
airmail letter right
okay.
back.
You're sure it was in the letter, would you put it in there?
Yeah.
Geez, I hope that means it is approval on check. Oh, he wants a copy of the manuscript to read before he writes the book.
I told you he was a cagey booger.
Yeah, but the son of a gun, you know, in one breath he tells me he's barely got time. He says, I'll have to keep it to one page, the forward. And then he turns around and says, but to do that one page, I'll have to read your whole manuscript.
Oh, naturally.
Well, I know, but, you know,
listen,
it takes him 5 minutes to dictate one page. You could take 10 minutes to do two pages, you know. That was
well, but listen, if
I
he puts some muscle in it, ones are going to be enough.
Oh, sure. Hell, all he has to do is write a paragraph. It's worth it. I'm sure he's a very, very, very literate person.
Well, can't do that.
No.
So somebody's going to catch it.
Yeah.
So, I think.
Well, I could reword it so that, you know,
you're right.
So that, you know, later, you know, as compared to the.
Yeah, chapter 9 and page 16, top of page, middle of page, the Super Cup performance discussion versus the 180 Cessna, which was not built until about late 52, 53. And the flights to the Mount Logan area, as I recall, were in the very early part of the 50s. So it's great to have a discussion of various types, but this was before the event of the 180 on the market.
So what would you have used then?
Well, the only thing you could use that was available was a super cup that would do the job. So that's what I used.
It didn't make any difference. You mentioned in your
Had a, later, 2 years later, I had a special engine installed in a practically brand new 170 Cessna, the old 340 A1A, 170 horsepower Lycoming engine, which I used. 1989 Coco was the number, and I used that 170 Cessna up to the 9,000 foot level. But it had certain shortcomings because I own five of these airplanes of the 170 0340 A1A 170 horsepower. That plane originally came out with 145 horsepower, and the additional horsepower gave it a tremendous weight.
The reason I wrote that in there, Don, on the tape, you mentioned, if I remember correctly, you described it like Hackett was a good mountaineer, but he wasn't capable of, you insinuated that he lacked the ability to pick a landing spot that would coincide with what you could do with an airplane, practically.
We was limited by the geography of the mountain. They wanted to make a western
place. So in other words, he picked as good a spot as possible.
Well, we both picked the place. It was no fault of his or mine that the wind was prevailing from the southeast. We picked the west approach, which would be downwind for the takeoff. See? And it just so happened that, sure enough, on the takeoffs, they were downwind, even on the about half of the
The way I'll word it then.
Through
geography, even though they had studied the area, it turned out that the prevailing wind caused them to have forced them to make downwind takeoffs, making the operation a tricky one.
And see, all these incoming weather systems, and at any other time segment, the winds may have been different or none at all. But during their particular inbound and outbound landings, he was always heckled by this big southeast wind, down on the crosswind from the left, the worst kind. Let me tell you about the airdrop. Professor Morrison Institute of Art Biology had a physiology testing team for the space age study on McKinley, and they were very active, and the first crew was a Smith expedition, and I airlifted them from the 8,200 foot level of Muldrow Glacier in 60, but later on, space age was very interested in the results of exertion at altitude, so they contacted climbers, and they run through the Institute of Arctic Biology, Fairbanks College, Alaska testing departments to find out the capabilities of the people at sea level, and then after they return from the mountain expedition climb, usually on McKinley, we'd rush the people back, and they'd run them back through the test and make a comparison before their acclimatization to the lower sea level, and they exchange the chemical composition of their blood. So
this was 67 or 68.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So this was active through 70.
I've got some pictures of that.
Right. And then our base landing area was 14,300 feet. And the people that write the books on physiology and altitude and anoxia and hypoxia and all the associated disasters with altitude, that usually middle-aged, heavy smokers, fat, obese, and all, and they would talk a storm up about what they plan to do with their blood centrifuges and all, and they would step out of the airplane, walk 3 feet, and glide with the ground or the ice. At any rate, Professor Morrison asked me how much it would cost to fly a billing into the 14G level, and I said 50 cents a pound. He said, that's pretty high. I said, yeah, but when I get it there, it's going to be in one piece.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be in a neatly stacked pile of 14,300 feet, period. And he says, we're considering an airdrop because this billing's heavier and it's cheaper. I say, if you airdrop anything from 18,000 feet, by the time it gets scattered over the west approach, you won't even be able to find the pieces. And that's the way it happened. That's what Hagman was talking about. He and Richard Wien or somebody went in this C-1, of the Irishman airplane. No, was it 130?
Well, that was the one they made the Hydra.
Well, they made
couldn't make the turn in that base.
They made a turn with...
And then they brought a Pilatus in.
No, not the Pilatus. They made a aircraft with a Irishman's airplane. What do you call that?
Oh,
short sky van.
Sky van?
Yeah, and man, they plastered that thing and almost hit my airplane on the ground with some of the junk that fell. Yo-ho!
Hi,
Doc.
Hi! Another first. They carried me that they got.
She walks all the way up the road.
Anyway, how's the swimming going?
Oh, good. Hey, I guess,
if you drown, it's all their fault.
That's right.
Good.
You didn't hear about your thing yet, though.
Well, he said I was up into the Red Cross.
I guess, but he's not telling me.
Yeah.
Myself, personally. But I know a lot of people who work for him and work around him, and I'm telling you, I guess, he's just the hardest thing to work around.
Yeah.
Now, he's an expert at one thing, and that is getting money. You know? But you can't get along with the people up there.
Yeah. Anyway, the procedure was to take in a team, and they would be subsidized. In other words, their time would be, the expense would be defrayed by the Institute of Archaeology. The climbers would pass through the 14-3 elevation where the blood centrifuges. Local scientists had given the business blood tests, red and white corpuscle counts, and the mechanical compositions of the blood and everything, and also a few more physical exercises to determine how they compared with their sea level rate. And then at 17.3, they had another setup, and most of the doctors couldn't get to 17.3 themselves, so it was a standard procedure for all the climbers to go around the 17.3 and to go by there in the middle of the night coming down the mountain, because the last thing they needed was a big blood sample or two out of each arm coming down when they were deathly ill from high altitude anyway, most of them. And so the big deal was to skirt this camp 17.3 and to try to get by the one at 14.3. And they often as not where they were successful and would escape the Institute of Archaeology who financed their
expedition.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you like it was.
Yeah, I know. We're getting the pictures for them.
Yeah, so then anyway, the blood samples they did pick up, they would sit in the Talkeet in the hangar and wait on the train. 3 or 4 days in a hot hangar, and this is highly perishable, fresh blood. So, by the way, blood is almost pure flying. Now, the reason